Ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Delaney versus the University of Houston.
May I please report, this is Lynn Fidel, we're arguing for our petition.
May it please the court, I'm Glenn Bedell. I have the privilege of appearing before this court on behalf of Ms. Andrea Marie Delaney, who is the petitioner in this cause. I will try to move briefly through my argument and not rehash what has been set out in some detail in the briefs. The first issue that we have is the question of whether Ms. Delaney has a cause of action for breach of contract. Submitted to the court as Exhibit 1 that should have been passed out to all members of the court is a sheet blowout of the contract.
Counsel, who did you submit that to?
The clerk had it last week and indicated that it was distributed to the court yesterday.
All right. You may proceed.
We do not have
it. Since most of us don't.
Must
be a failure of our individual offices.
Well, bear with me then. The contract is drawn on an 8.5 by 14 sheet. By the University of Houston, labeling it on the space contract. The critical provision, it's a housing contract, part of the contract documents that Ms. Delaney signed in coming to the university. It says on its face, terms of contract, this contract is legal and binding for the period set forth. The question I think that we deal with, and have dealt with as this case has worked its way to this court, is whether the university who has the capacity to enter into contracts and sue and be sued for breach of contract can nevertheless walk away from an action to enforce a contract when it has breached it. We contend that Ms. Delaney has a right to sue the university for breach of contract. Her pleadings state so, and that Texas does not create a situation where the university, as a state agency, can disavow contractual obligations on the claim that sovereign immunity somehow reaches beyond the pale of tort law.
What's the breach?
The breach in this case was failure to provide a habitable premises.
Where is that guaranteed covenant?
That's guaranteed by operation of law. It's an implied covenant under CAMRAP and also 92.5659 and 60 of the property code. It requires a landlord to maintain and restore premises after notice of defect.
And is that door to her room locked?
The door where the assailant came in was the outside door, and that was unlocked. It was unlocked.
Was the door to her room locked?
The record does not indicate at the time he came in. It was locked before he came in. She had friends that left her room shortly before, and the question is whether he was waiting and came in before she relocked it. My guess is it probably was her door itself is probably unlocked for some brief period of time between the time the assailant had come into the dorm through the door that was propped open because it was inoperative at the time he came in. That's the breach that is historically recognized as a covenant that can run by contract between a landlord and a tenant. It is just as viable and cognizable as a roof that doesn't keep water out, or walls that crumble, or toilets that don't flush. All terms, incidentally, that have to be complied with pursuant to the Houston Housing Code as well. There is no question.
Is there any legal provision that's got to have a workable lock and be locked?
I think so.
Where?
That applies to operation of law because the Houston Housing Code requires locking outside doors. It's incumbent on the university as a landlord, as somebody who holds land in Houston, it also, as a matter of law, is an implied as part of the covenant of habitability. That issue, interestingly enough, was never challenged in the trial court. In other words, Mrs. Delaney's contract's pleadings went to the trial judge as presumptively valid. In fact, she pleaded under Rule 54 that all conditions precedent had occurred or had been performed. So that's not even a question. She claimed a breach. The court had to presume there was a breach. It ruled there could never be an action for breach of contract. Period. The case law is consistent, starting with Chief Judge Brown's opinion in Bristow versus Blum in 1898, going up more recently to Bache Halsey versus the University of Houston, most recently to a decision of the Dallas court this year, the Industrial Construction Management Company versus DeSoto Independent School District case, and finally, ending with a case I'll talk about in a second called Ehrlich-Boeber versus University of Houston. This line of cases has steadfastly said when the state decides to enter a contract, it leaves its immunity behind. It becomes a commercial entity, and in commerce acts as any other private citizen. Of course, it's logical. If that were not the case, there would be no contract. If that were not the case, we would be talking about reviving a doctrine of past consideration, saying at some point in time in the future, the state can say, well, maybe there's a contract, maybe not. These cases, this line starting with Bristow versus Blum, working up to this recent decision by the Dallas court, consistently say, Article 1, Section 16 of the Texas Constitution gives you a right to an action for breach of contract. It cannot be altered or impaired by acts of the legislature or constitutional amendment.
You don't claim that there's an action for breach of contract because of anything that someone associated or employed by the University of Houston said.
That is part the, there are, as the pleadings went in this case, there were several layers of contractual obligation being enforced. There were distinct one document called the housing contract. There was also an allegation there was a contract memorialized in part in writing and orally on the basis of express representations made to Ms. Delaney by the University of Houston's recruiters when they went to Chicago to bring her down here. The contract went for a term of 8 months. So as to other obligations undertaken that did not strictly run with the premises, which was in writing, there were collateral obligations with adequate consideration that formed the basis of contract claim.
Don't you have a problem, though, with the authority of those representatives to make those statements and promises?
That issue has never been raised. The pleadings are presumptively valid as to capacity to enter into those representations. I'll tell you, I don't have any problem with this document at all. This was signed by a designee of the Board of Regents. It is the contract that is used by the university. They've admitted it's their contract. So I don't have a problem with that. And I think that it would be looking small to miss the issue on that point, because the position the university has taken unequivocally, which is what is so significant and seminal about this case, is that the state can enter any contract. Doesn't matter whether it's housing, doesn't matter whether it's buying basketballs, dry goods, equipment, and not be liable for an action for breach of contract. Theory? There is no remedy for breach of contract. Conveyed. If there is no remedy, inferably, one does not have a right. If there's no right, there is no contract with the state. That is the position that we are poised to consider in this case. That is how this case has come up from the district court. This case has been pleaded on Article 1, Section 16 of the Texas Constitution. There was no exception to the sufficiency of the contract allegations at all. Under Nixon, Castle versus Brand, Judge Phillips' opinion, Castle versus Brand, earlier case in Nixon, those pleadings are presumptively valid on summary judgment.
Changing the subject.
Sure.
The Tort Claims Act, right?
Yeah.
How was the injury in this case approximately caused by the failure to have a lock in the building?
The answer to that is fairly straightforward. As you know, going back and reference Section 101.0212, which goes to the management of real tangible property, and The, did you say proprietary activities or did you say tort claims act?
Proprietary.
The, also the mismanagement of premises exception, which is 0.022, put the state in a position that a private citizen would be in. Our law has an exception to the general rule that private citizens are not liable for the intentional torts of third parties in those instances where the tort is foreseeable. That's Nixon versus Mr. Property. A Dallas Housing Code case. The question was it foreseeable if the attack could occur? It was held by the Supreme Court following the restatement of tort second. We will find liability in those situations following the majority of jurisdictions. So that's how that comes back. The
if the attacker in this case had kicked the locked door down as opposed to going through an unlocked door, would there be liability on the part of the university?
Well, there would definitely be an argument by the university at that point in time that there would be no liability because they had been reasonable. They had had a competent safe door. They had met the negligence per se standard under housing codes. They had been reasonable. No breach of a duty implied by law.
But these outer doors we're talking about are steel doors, aren't they?
The answer to that is the implication of a steel door is a non-functional door. This is the door to the parking lot, and the way it was used, the students used keys to open it. It did not have a handle on it. It was the access door immediate to the parking lot. It was regularly used by the students for that purpose and still is to this day.
But it was made out of steel.
I don't know, Judge. I would assume that if the door complied with the housing code, it was, because it would have to be fire resistant.
Nevertheless, the university had to go through the trial, and it could be found negligent, not negligent, depending on the verdict.
That's right.
Even if it had locked the door and stayed in the guard.
Well,
somehow he got in and didn't want to get inside.
That would be the argument as it is in any tort case. That's the defense. I wasn't negligent. I mean, at the point that you try to pull hairs on that one, the question is there a causal complaint or not, and then you're subject to regular defenses, motion for summary judgment, whatever.
Was there room on the first, second, and third level?
I believe it was the first level. One case that you might want to look at closely on the breach of contract issues that was miscited in the brief Arashi went to earlier was Ehrlich Bober versus the University of Houston, following Bache Halsey holding the university liable for its contracts. That was a case in which the university, with some unspecified funds, purchased $12.5 million of securities for its portfolio on what's called the reverse repurchase deal. They did it by telephone to their account at Bache Halsey Stewart in New York. Don't know where they get that kind of money, but it's impressive. The New York Court of Appeals took the case up and said, I'm sorry, sovereign immunity doesn't apply. This is clearly commercial activity. You're liable to Bache Halsey Stewart. The second point that I briefed is the one that I want to focus on a little more carefully. It's the proprietary activities exception. It is our position under Texas law as it stands now, under Section 5.001 of the Remedies Code, and Chief Justice Brown's opinion in Grigsby v. Reeve in 1913, that Ms. Delaney has a cause of action under the proprietary activities exception as recognized in other jurisdictions. Until the 5.001 says, if the Supreme Court has not ruled on this issue, we look to the law of other jurisdictions. Until this court says no. An interesting comparison case is the Richards case cited by my brother Mr. Flores in his brief written by Judge Staten, who wrote the Posnowski opinion that is perhaps the seminal case in the definition of proprietary activity in Texas. And Richards is earlier than Grigsby, but it's clear that 5.001 gives her that right at this time until this court says no, you can't do that. Why have that exception? It's the question I think each court that has considered this has dealt with. Justice Ellis in the Court of Appeals wrote quite eloquently on this that it only makes sense that when a university engages in privately oriented activity of the kind normal people do for its own gain, that it should be held liable as a private individual. Exhibit 2 submitted to the court.
Counsel, your time has expired.
I'm sorry, Judge.
But you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Does anybody have any questions? Please put it out at this time. Thank you, counsel.
Sure.
The court is ready to hear oral argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Roberto Flores will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. What this case really involves is the issue of sovereign immunity and whether the legislature meant what it said when it wrote Section 101.057 into the Tort Claims Act. And that's the exception that we're talking about here that I think really applies to this situation. We have an assault or an intentional tort at the University of Houston dormitory. No question.
Did she have a contract with the University of Houston?
She had a housing contract, Your Honor. She had a scholarship with the University of Houston. That's undisputed.
What about her rights under that contract?
The rights under the contract are barred by sovereign immunity. That's why I say this case deals with sovereign immunity. The cases we cite, Hayden versus Dodson, Frencher versus the director versus the printing industries, Supreme Court cases, all state proposition, the basic proposition.
Counsel,
that
did you say the rights were barred by sovereign immunity?
The contract
rights were barred by sovereign immunity?
That's correct, Your Honor.
What is the contract?
Well, the way I understand plaintiff's position or petitioner's position here is that she has a contract with the university, and because of the contract, which in her words are, she has a housing contract with the university, therefore establishing a landlord-tenant relationship. If I understand that correctly, then she's claiming, I have a right to sue the University of Houston for breach of any contract that would arise from that landlord-tenant relationship. Since 1847, when Hosner versus DeYoung was handed down by this court, the court has specifically stated, as to sovereign immunity, no suits can be brought against the state, or in this case, the University of Houston, without the express legislative consent being granted to the claimant in that case. Well, the problem that petitioner has in this case is that they don't have legislative consent to bring a suit against the University of Houston. They don't have a legislative resolution. They do not have a statute that allows them to bring a contract claim against the university. They're trying to come in under the Tort Claims Act, but I think that is also barred. As far as...
Is it your position that Mr. Fidel seems to characterize it, that if the university ordered 10 basketballs, took delivery, refused to pay for them, the indoor would just be out of luck, unless they could get the legislature to let them sue the university?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. And that's the way the Supreme Court has ruled as to sovereign immunity applying to contract claims. Unless you go through the procedure allowed in obtaining the legislative resolution to allow that lawsuit against the state, that's where we talk about in our brief about immunity from suit as opposed to immunity from liability. Clearly, if Ms. Delaney were to obtain legislative consent to bring the lawsuit, then you stand in the same shoes, the university would stand in the same shoes that Mr. Diddle was talking about, where you stand in the shoes of a private person in there. Therefore, your contract rights are determined as a private individual would be determined. But that is, you have to meet that first test, the first prong of that test. You have to obtain legislative consent, something that Ms. Delaney does not have in this case. In her brief and at the trial court, Ms. Delaney tried to argue that Section 111.33 of the Education Code granted her that consent. Well, that may have been true back when Fazekas was decided, one of the cases that Ms. Delaney cites in her brief. But after Fazekas was decided, and prior to Ms. Delaney actually filing the lawsuit here, let me give you a little bit of that chronology. The assault occurred in March of 1984. In August of 1985, the legislature came back and amended 111.33 in response to the Fazekas holding. Fazekas had held because 111.33, and we cited in our brief, basically states the university, this section grants the university consent to sue or be sued. And that's basically, it finished at that phrase. What the legislature did in 85 is come back and expressly write into the legislation a provision that said, this does not grant consent does not waive sovereign immunity of the university. And then, when that was enacted in August of 85, was effective in August of 85. In June of 86 was when Ms. Delaney filed her suit. The provision had already been amended, saying the sue or be sued legislation really does not waive or grant legislative consent to sue for any kind of action, contract action included. And it was very specific about that. So we've got a suit that the contract claim is barred, and Ms. Delaney is trying to assert now a tort claims case. And our position is that the tort claims case is barred by 057, the assault and intentional tort exception to the Act.
Why isn't this permitted by the use of real personal property exception?
Basically because the way the courts have interpreted it, Your Honor, and I think the plain and unambiguous meaning of the statute is that it applies whenever the damages or the result of the intentional tort or the criminal conduct in this case. The two primary cases we cite in our brief are Little versus Schaefer, which is a federal district court case, and more importantly, Townsend versus Memorial Medical Center, which is a writ refused NRE case from 1975.
But if the door had been locked, you wouldn't have gotten it.
That's the issue that was addressed by Townsend. They said, okay, let's assume that you can allege a use or condition of real property, as in this case, broken lock. You still have to overcome the hurdle that is posed by 057 of the Act, which talks about the assaults or intentional torts. And they say you have to read those two provisions together. If 057 applies in the situation, then it controls the general waiver of sovereign immunity granted by 021 and 022, which are the use of property provisions and the condition of real property provisions. And so the court holds, if you read those two together, then 057 controls. And I want to cite this court to some key language from that case. Basically, the court is holding, although appellant claims that the rape is not the gist of her complaint, the petition leaves no other fair construction possible. And I think that's the situation we have here. Clearly in her petition, and we've cited in our brief, her petition, Ms. Delaney specifically admits that her damages are the result, are the proximate result of the rape that occurred in March of 1984.
So the state's position is that any time you have a situation in which there is an intentional conduct like that, but also negligence, that the fact that you have one precludes any liability on the part of the state as to the other?
We believe that's correct, Your Honor, and the reason for that is that if the legislature had intended to allow claims such as an artful attorney would be able to craft in any given situation, you would always be able to craft a pleading that states a use of property or a condition of real property. Take, for instance, a breakout at the TDC prison. You could always claim, well, you really had a broken lock in that case, which allowed easier access from the prison. Then you have an intentional tort on down the road. It's not the intentional tort then that the attorney is going to be focusing on, but it's going to be the condition of the real property at the TDC prison. In this case, what I believe Ms. Delaney is attempting to do is circumvent that very specific exception, 057, by crafting or pleading in either a condition of real property or premise defect, basically with a broken lock, or
we have held private, apart from the involvement of the government, that if negligence and an intentional tort are run together, in Mr. Nixon, for example, you can recover from negligence. But you say this is different in the area of government.
Yes, Your Honor, this is very distinguishable, especially because of that feature, because it does involve the state. Clearly, in Mr. Nixon, the court went on and ruled on the foreseeability feature of the criminal activity and based its reasoning primarily on Section 448 of the Restatement of Torts. And in that section, pretty much the first part of Section 448 tracks the language as it's found in 057 of the Tort Claims Act. And it basically states that the act of a third person in committing an intentional tort or crime is a superseding cause of harm to another. And therefore, that actor, in this case the university, will not be held liable. But then the caveat comes in, unless the actor at the time of his negligent conduct realized or should have realized the likelihood that such a situation might have occurred. And that's where the court discusses the foreseeability feature. Well, that, the court, this court, based its opinion in Nixon much on that second language, second part of the section, Section 448. That, however, is not what is, it's just this second exception is not contained in 057. And I think the legislature was pretty clear that 057 applied to any intentional torts or assaults on state property. And
Young versus the city of Demet earlier this year, we had a police officer who intentionally ran his car into oncoming traffic in an effort to commit suicide. The victim sued for negligent employment of the officer. And we held that, the Court of Appeals held that the suit was barred because it was an intentional tort. The officer had intentionally run his car into oncoming traffic. We held that while that was certainly true, his liability for negligent, the city's liability for negligent employment was not barred by, might not be barred by sovereign immunity. What is your response to that?
That's correct, Your Honor. As far as the negligent employment, however, I don't think this court gave us sufficient guidance with the language in the per curiam opinion to really be helpful in this sort of situation, because the way I interpret 021 and 022, it would read that negligent employment really wouldn't fit into the use of tangible property, use of a motor vehicle, or a condition of real property, the three main sections that have been the bulwark of what a tort claims case is all about. The negligent employment really doesn't fit within those three categories of the Tort Claims Act. And
but door locks do.
Door locks do, Your Honor. And that's why I'm saying that any crafty pleader would be able to circumvent this very specific exception, however, and plead any condition of use of real property. One other point is that if the legislature had intended in 1970 to allow for a foreseeability provision in 057, they could easily have provided for that by writing it in, just like it's written into the Section 448 in the Restatement of Torts.
On the proprietary governmental distinction, you claim that Texas law just does not recognize the action of the petitioner.
That's correct, Your Honor. We believe it's pretty clear from Bennett versus Brown County Water Improvement District, which we cite in our brief, and State versus Brandon also, that the history and the law in Texas is such that the proprietary versus governmental distinction that the plaintiff would like this court to impose upon the university in this case just does not apply to a state or a state agency. It applies, and it's a specific creature of municipal law. It applies to cities. There's a very specific provision in the Tort Claims Act that identifies proprietary functions of cities, and that is just a creature of municipal law as opposed to being applicable to the state or state agencies. And we feel that it's pretty clear what this court has ruled in the past, that proprietary versus governmental distinction just is not applicable as to the state or state agency. The last point I want to make is as to the contract claims that Ms. Delaney has been making in this case, and that is that extensive, besides the cases that we cite in our brief, there's some law review articles that are very well researched and right on point as to the contract claim not being able to be lodged against the university for breach of contract, and I'll just cite the court to one of those. It's a seminal article written in 1949, 27 Texas Law Review 337, which basically states that you need that legislative consent in order to sue a state for breach of contract.
Any
Further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear rebuttal argument.
First point, we don't believe legislative consent is necessary for the reasons stated, starting with Fristo up and through the recent Dallas case. But the fact is, we haven't, because Section 111.33 of the Education Code, as unamended, was the prevailing statute at the time this contract was signed. If you want to espouse a rule of law that allows for retroactive abrogation of that right, we are running afoul of Article 16, Article 1, Section 16 of the Texas Constitution, Article 1, Section 29, which specifically prohibits that, as well as Article 6, Section 2 of the Federal Constitution. That is a no-brainer in terms of the case law. It's fairly straightforward that you cannot retroactively abrogate contract terms. But more importantly, my brother misstates what happened in 1985. I had the questionable pleasure of listening to the audio tapes, which are available to the court from the Capitol Library, and there was not one mention of Physicus anywhere in those tapes. There was not one mention of the case Physicus in the report from the House. Senate Bill 605 and House Bill 1182 went in with no testimony taken at public hearing, and as far as we can tell, no debate. Plain reading of the amended statute has the same provisions in concerning sue and be sued. It says, and as otherwise provided by law, it does not mention anything about sovereign immunity. The arguable and clear reading of that would be that obviously in filing a cause of action for breach of contract on the part of the state does not waive any defense it might have to a counterclaim under the sovereign immunity doctrine in tort. That would be a logical reading of that provision. No matter how imaginative I get, I cannot find the words that my brother claims is either in the statute or the legislative history, but perhaps smarter and more abler minds than mine can find it. The issue on contracts is absolutely essential. The rule of law that the state asks you to promulgate today is a right to retroactively walk away from any contract. Any contract. And that is just not only outrageous, it's unconstitutional. Here we have an entity that has a proprietary activity that earns $7 million a year, not a dime of which goes to the Treasury of the state of Texas, not a dime of which goes back to the general fund, that is part of an enterprise system that earns this school approximately $30 million a year. And it is saying that it can walk away from a contract involved with that activity, count its money, and tell the world to take a hike? That is outrageous. And that is an affront to our Constitution, federal and state. That is not what was intended to happen. The university, as an entity capable of entering into a contract, can contract to do anything. It can contract for duties to be liable for personal injuries. It can contract for duties of any kind. The only distinction between contract and tort in this regard is where the duty comes from. It either arises as an operation of law or by an agreement between two parties who have the capacity to contract. And so long as a state agency has the capacity to enter a contract, it can contract freely. But in doing so, as Chief Justice Brown said, it is liable as any of us are, without restriction. The cases that go for consent, which really don't apply here because we had consent, create a real problem because it deals with retroactive abrogation. And like the university said, well, maybe I don't want to recognize this contract now. It's going to cost me money. It's an early FOBR. I mean, they owed this New York stock firm a lot of money, $11 million. You know, they didn't want to pay it. They entered this sophisticated Wall Street transaction, a reverse repurchase. I have to sit down and diagram it every time I read it. Find out what it is, but you know, these very, very smart, clever people understood it. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the court submission schedule for today. The foregoing causes are submitted on brief and oral arguments. The marshal will now please adjourn the court.
Audience will please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.